Good afternoon and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 52. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, and the warm weather that I was talking about last episode is pretty much gone now. The leaves are now almost completely gone off the trees. There's just a few maple trees, and it seems like they're not even all the same variety of maple, because the leaves are a little bit different, but they are indeed all maple trees. That they're just clinging on to those last few yellow leaves. And anyway, leaves everywhere. They've been falling very quickly in this neighborhood, at least. I'm just glad I don't have to rake them. I have some listener mail and comments, and I will get right to those. I have a comment here from Doug in Akeley, Iowa. Doug had this to say about episode number 50, and I had asked specifically about what people's favorite foods are. And Doug had this to say, well, right now my fave foods are hot dogs, cold meat, and beefaroni. But otherwise, pizza, lasagna, Big Macs, and Subway. Well, thank you, Doug, for the comment. That's a very fat-heavy list of favorites, isn't it? Not the healthiest stuff. But I hear what you're saying about hot dogs, cold meat, and beefaroni. And right now, and you and I are in, you know, somewhat similar situations right now, but neither one of us having work. And right now, I think a lot of what I'm having, I'm surviving on wheat thins, peanut butter, and notice, not peanut butter sandwiches. I'm just eating, just having it right out of the jar. Honestly, I mean, the usual stuff. I'm trying not to spend as much on meals. One of the things, I actually am spending a lot less on food now that I'm not employed. And that's because I'm not going to lunch every day. And I'm having just something small here. And that's always good. But yeah, I mean, your favorites are pretty much on line with mine, even though it's kind of fatty, isn't it? Pizza, of course, a huge favorite of mine. Lasagna, I love veggie lasagna. And I know that Ross Patzel said, what's the point of veggie lasagna? Well, it's an entirely different experience than a lot of other types of lasagna. And I like it as its own thing. Even back when I was eating meat, even, you know, years ago when I was still eating meat, I liked veggie lasagna because it's different. It's not the same thing. Now, Big Macs, obviously, I don't eat. But Subway, now, it may be just me, but Subway, I don't think, is as good now as it used to be. Or maybe it's a regional thing. I have to say, I've eaten at Subway, you know, maybe once or twice a year for the last few years, and maybe a little bit more than that last year because I worked very close to a Subway. But I don't think it's as good as it used to be, even though they've introduced a lot of new type things, like different types of bread and different things. I used to like their Veggie Max sandwich, which was an artificial meat patty, and I used to get that from time to time. But it seems to me, though, that, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, back in Florida, Subway was a whole lot better. And I could get a cheese sub, you know, just a proper cheese sub, and it wouldn't just have three slices of fake American cheese on it. It actually would have real, it'd be like a real sandwich instead of just, you know, three slices, you know, the little triangles of cheese and a bunch of veggies. And they don't really charge that much less for it. So that's one of those things I have a gripe with, is when sandwich shops, and this is true of grocery store delis as well, and they do a cheese sandwich, they really skimp on the cheese. And they charge you the same as though it were one of their big meat sandwiches for it. And so I've actually had this conversation with the people at the deli. It's like I'm ordering a cheese sub. I want as much cheese on that sub as you would put meat on a meat sub. And they look very confused, as though, you know, why would you possibly want that? You know, it but truth to tell, I don't go to grocery store delis very often and get sandwiches. It's every once in a very, very great while. And I didn't have that problem when I was overseas. For example, when I was over in the UK, I stopped at a couple sandwich shops during the time I was there, because I just had a hankering for, you know, like a baguette or sub. They don't really have like the big American style subs over there. They usually do their subs, they're smaller and on a baguette. And maybe Subway over there has the American style subs, but I didn't bother stopping at the Subway over there. But I would get the Plowman sandwich, and was never dissatisfied with the amount of cheese on it or the amount of toppings. It's a little bit different, but it was usually very, very satisfying. There used to be, actually it's still there, I just don't work downtown anymore. There's a sandwich shop downtown that I used to go to once a week when I was working down in the Loop, and they do a wonderful cheese sub there. They actually, I mean, all of their subs look good. Most of their subs I don't eat. The cheese sub they do there is a really good sub, really, really good value. The name of the sandwich shop is Fontano's. They have, I think, two or three locations in Chicago. It's not a very big chain, but it is a family-run business, and it's not a corporate entity type thing. So I really like their stuff. And actually, when I was down there doing interviews a couple weeks ago, I stopped there both of those days and got subs from Fontano's, and even though it was a little bit out of my way, it was definitely worth that. It's one of the things about working down there that I miss now that I'm not working down there anymore. A very warm welcome to Steve in Tampa, I believe it is. That's going to get confusing because I know two Steves in Tampa, and I think both of them are listening to the show. Steve had this to say about episode 51, last episode. He said, the last time I saw Head, and he's talking about the Monkees movie that I talked about last time, was at your place, the one you lived in before the house back in the 80s. Yeah, that was probably because we were hanging out then. That was during that general period, 84 to 86, when you and I were hanging out a lot. Yeah, and that was probably the same time I taped it off the television, like at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that would have been when I was working at the comic shop and Richard was working at the comic shop and all of that. So that would have been all right around that same era. Del and I built our house in 1986. So that was when, you know, it had to have been before that. So between 84 and 86. And Pete would be very quick to remind me that he was -2 at the time. Steve goes on to say, that was a very good breakdown of cold reading. It's so creepy watching people being taken in by that. That's probably why I prefer to give mine by email. There's less interaction. As I mentioned before, Steve is a telephone/email psychic. But I will say this in Steve's defense, and you know, is that he does something right in what he's doing, is that he is providing lots of disclaimers, and the disclaimers are not in microscopic type. I mean, they're there and clearly legible. Now, most of the people out there who do this sort of thing want you to believe that they have some sort of really, really developed extrasensory supernatural abilities, and Steve has disclaimers all over his site about being for entertainment purposes only. And of course, yeah, your thing is mainly tarot readings, right, Steve? I seem to remember that. And I do definitely feel different about tarot than I do about most of the other so-called psychic things, because tarot, as I was talking about when I discussed it, and that would have been back quite a while now, but feel free to go back into my old episodes and look for it was a two-parter on tarot readings, and I did tarot on the show, where it really, to me, is not a psychic thing at all. It's really all about putting things into order mentally. Somebody is telling you raw data based on what the traditional interpretation of the cards is, and any meaning that it has is interpreted by you. It has nothing to do with, you know, any kind of magical ability or psychic ability or the cards being magic or evil or however you want to present that. And yeah, you know, it's pieces of cardboard. And I've talked about that many times, and we'll probably continue to talk about it many times. But anyway, thanks, Steve, for that. One last mail here. This one is from our good friend Robert, Robert the Viking in Iceland, who is the king of the elves. And Robert has this to say, "Dear Tom, you asked me if I was an elf, and in answer, I have to say no." Well, how can you be the king of the elves if you're not an elf? Whether they exist or not is a good point, and yet in a way they do, for they are the thrill rides of the mind, given over to stories told around a flickering candle. My stories are a way to deal with an overactive imagination. The story read out on the United Kingdom talk show was a request from Joe Morris. It was a poorly written affair, and no, I'm not fishing for compliments, but it did spur an interest to write more on the subject, and hence I am now well into writing the history of the Dark Elves, plus an anthology. Another story that is somewhat further along takes its premise the painting of the Mona Lisa. On one such visit to the Louvre, my Brigitta turned to me and asked what one would do if it turned out to be a fake, and hence the start of an idea. The house on the hill of Montmartre was born. I have shown some of my friends the first draft, and alas, the name of Dan Brown came up. Yeah, it would. Now, I actually enjoy the writings of Dan Brown, though I actually prefer the film versions, but my book is nothing like Dan Brown. It shares some locations, and that is all. Today, as I write my report from the far-flung post of Empire, I note we have moved from a warm Saturday to a rather wintry Sunday with flurries of snow and its decided chill to the air. The weather at this time of year has some difficulty in making up its mind, and we are teased with hints of what is yet to come. We have yet to switch over to winter tires, almost as if we can in some mystic way influence the winter god to stay his hand. Silly people, perhaps, and yet communities that know the feeling of isolation are minded towards this outlook. Perhaps it is a time when elves and trolls walk the land. I would counsel the mind towards a rational mindset in one's dealings with the world, and yet allow time for the mind to run through fields of wildflowers and for a while dip one's toes into a river of possibilities. From Robert Pels in Iceland. Thank you very much, Robert. What a lovely little email there. I don't think the story that you wrote for Chris Reardon was poorly written. I thought it was quite charming. I don't see any problem with the story in general. I mean, it was occasionally very silly and had little in jokes, but that added to my enjoyment of the show because I actually knew the various personalities that you were kind of skewering. For example, Chris Reardon having treasure hidden in his garden shed. It was all very charming, really. But I am interested in seeing what you come up with as far both in the story of the Dark Elves and also in this other idea that you have about the Mona Lisa. Of course, there's been many people who've speculated about whether or not the Mona Lisa is real or not, and the idea, of course, is that the Mona Lisa was very famously stolen at I think it was 1909 or some time like that, and it took them some time to recover it. And there's been a lot of speculation that perhaps the painting that's on display isn't real, that in fact that it is a copy, and they put it there because they don't want to put the real one on display, and because they have the sheet of glass in front of it and you can't really get close to it, you can't really verify. If you're an art expert and you go and look at it, you might be able to tell, it's not real. And that's why they keep people from getting a close-up view over it. I mean, for all we know, it could be a poster from the gift shop that they they stick in the frame. And interestingly enough, and if you're writing about the Mona Lisa, you should probably have a look at this, it's an old Doctor Who story from the Tom Baker era. I don't remember the name of the story right now. Oh, wait, yes, I do. It was called The City of Death, and it was written by Douglas Adams. And it actually involves Leonardo painting multiple copies of the Mona Lisa by the design of an alien intelligence who, for some reason, wanted many copies. Maybe it was just purely for wealth purposes, the doctor went into Leonardo's studio and wrote all over the canvases before Leonardo painted them, "This is a fake." And just told him to paint over what he had written. And so, you know, even though they were actually real Mona Lisas painted by Leonardo, they were also fakes. Interesting. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how this turns out, and if the writing the elf story spurred you on to go further and actually write something more serious, then more power to you. That's all I can say. Now about elves and trolls, and I have to say, you know, I do have a fondness for stories. I do have. I mean, I used to be a comic collector. I dabbled in creative writing myself. Never was very good at it, but certainly I do appreciate this idea of the mystery and the imagination and so forth. I certainly do appreciate that. Now, just because I do prefer nonfiction type books, travel accounts and histories and biographies and that sort of thing. But for example, I just finished reading the Harry Potter series and enjoyed that very much. Don't actually take it seriously as something that would be realistic, obviously, but it's something that I do enjoy. And even though I don't read a lot of fiction, I certainly am open to reading fiction. And including, you know, things like Dan Brown. I mean, I've read his first two books. I haven't read anything since Da Vinci Code, but would be open to reading it. And of course, right now I have time to read stuff like that, and I'm not. So, what does that say? At any rate, my point is that, you know, I do have an appreciation for folklore and for stories and so forth, and I don't get all analytical about mythology, but I also don't take it as fact, and that's what a lot of people do when it comes to religion. And I can be analytical and enjoy a bit of fantasy at the same time. And of course, you know, obviously, because I'm familiar with Doctor Who, and I'm a big old geek. I have some audio comments here from Scott. Now, I'm not going to play them all on this show. I don't have nearly enough time. But I am going to play one of them on this show, and the others I'll play at a later time or respond to privately. Anyhow, Scott had this to say about episode 51.
Tom, that was a very interesting podcast that you just did on cold reading. Much enjoyed that. I had heard about cold reading. I had a vague idea how it worked. But going through some of the specifics like that really kind of does a great job of illustrating, I thought. And I've always kind of known what that's all about, and pretty much totally agree about psychics and cold readers. We used to have that John Edwards jerk on our station, and it was on for a while, and I just detested watching what he was doing, because it just feels like he's a ripoff. He is a ripoff. Now, as I said, the only question I have to ask about that is, how do we separate the good that's done from the bad that's done? And you say, what good could possibly have done by that? Well, that kind of ties together with, you know, one of the end questions you asked and then answered yourself, which was, why do people do this? And what you didn't really stress enough, you know, you were saying that they're fooled into believing it, but the biggest thing is that they need to believe in it. They have a pain, or usually everything in life goes back to pain and pleasure of some kind at some level. And in the case of death, we all want, it's great to think that we can talk with somebody who's dead. They can still be a part of our life. There's always a hole left by anybody we loved when they pass away. And we want to believe that somehow, you know, there's still a connection there. They're with us spiritually or whatever. This is something that feels real good to most human beings. Now, I don't know how atheists deal with that. I don't know if atheists are more disconnected from other people so that when the connection is broken, they just don't feel it. That's something maybe you can comment on. Because, I think is your mom still alive? I guess she is, yeah. And maybe your father. Yeah, I think you said your father was too. Anyway, you know, if you've had a death of somebody extraordinarily close to you, how do you deal with that? Do you feel that connection? And isn't there this little wish that wants to think that somehow they still watch over me, they're still there, they know I'll see them again someday. They're in a better place. You know, all the platitudes that people who have some kind of spiritual belief or whatever have to make themselves feel better, and they can help to get over it that way. How do you get over it when the word is they're dead? No, I'm not going to see them again. No, that's it. They're gone, and they're gone forever, and they don't see me, and they never saw it coming, or whatever, you know. And that's a tough thing. I don't know how that's dealt with. You know, I can't imagine the mindset, because personally, it's a need. I feel like I would have a need to believe that at some level, somebody I dearly love could kind of still maybe understand what's going on in my life, or that maybe I'll see him again someday, or whatever. I don't know. It's hard to describe. But there is this big disconnect when somebody dies. And I think that's got to be a much rougher time for somebody who doesn't have these beliefs or platitudes, albeit bullshit, to go on.
Okay, I think that's a good place as any to cut for a comment. There is more to this comment, which I'll get to in a bit. The point that Scott is making here is he's saying that you need to balance the harm that the cold readers do against the good that they do. And I'll be perfectly honest, I don't see that they're doing any good at all, Scott. And the reason why I feel that way is that, well, let me put it this way. So you have this need of people who have lost loved ones to deal with their grief, to deal with the fact that these people are gone and they're not going to see them again. And people like John Edward, they come along and they tell them, okay, well, you're, you know, Aunt Tilly or Granddad or whoever are happy in the afterlife and they're looking after you and so forth. And I guess this could have the effect of making some people feel better about their loss and maybe be not so hurt. I mean, you'll notice he never says, you know, Granddad is in hell and he's burning for all eternity and he's really angry with you. Yeah, because that would not be a very good moneymaker for him. But the ends don't justify the means. And I don't think that really they're doing any good at all, because John Edward makes a lot of money from these people who come to see him. Now, maybe these people are, you know, they're forking over their dough willingly. They have that right. But he's not offering them anything of value for it. He's actually offering them empty words and outright fabrication. So you could argue, and I do argue, that he's ethically challenged at best, because A, he's taking advantage of people's grief to make money. And that's what it really comes down to. He's making money off this. He's making a lot of money off this. Not just from the people who are paying their admission to come see him talk, but from the syndication fees or the show, et cetera, et cetera. So he's making a buttload of money off these people's grief. I guarantee you he wouldn't do this stuff for free. And maybe some people do feel better, but it's based on lies. I do kind of wonder something here. I just thought of that, you know, what if there really is an afterlife and you die and you end up going there and you say, oh, yeah, I got your message from, you know, John Edward or whoever. And your relative looks at you and says, I never said that. Oh, that guy was a ripoff. Anyway, what he's doing is based on fabrication. And that is why I feel that people like John Edward are, and most cold readers in general, are just odious. It really is harmful, even if it does sort of make people feel better, kind of, you know. It is based on a falsehood. It is based on something that's not real. Now, do people need to feel better? Yes, but they should deal with this in a realistic way. They can deal with it through their religion if they like. That's their right. They can believe whatever they want. But the fact of the matter is that when people die, they are gone. And they are gone forever. And you're not going to see them again. Is that horrible? Well, yeah, it's sad. But that's the way it is. It might be comforting to think, yes, I'm going to see these people again after I die. But what good does that do? Because, of course, nobody knows. Nobody's ever come back. So it's not, you know, there's no evidence to support the idea that people have any kind of an afterlife at all. Now, as to your question you had about whether atheists feel disconnected from people and so forth, I'm just slightly offended by that. And not majorly offended, but it's an odd question. And actually, it's the reverse. I think that atheists feel the pain worse. Obviously, if you know that when somebody is gone, they're gone for good, you're going to value them more while they're alive. And I think that's largely true. I think that we do appreciate each other more when they're alive because we know that when they're gone, they're gone. And when they're gone, it hurts just as much, if not more, because we know we're not going to see them. Is it reassuring? Is it comforting? Well, no, but, you know, death is death. We know that these people will continue to exist as long as we remember them. And, you know, obviously if you're dealing with somebody who has made an impact on the world, somebody who's created a body of work that people can look at and remember them, then people can remember them that way. But it doesn't do me any good to think, oh, you know, grandmother might be watching from above, and when I know that that's not the case. She's gone. And I often think of my grandmother, and I miss her. So, you know, people who are atheists certainly have an emotional tie to people, just as anyone else does. And like I said, in the sense of loss, the loss is made keener by the fact that we know we're not going to see them again. Do we need to believe in a fantasy to make ourselves feel better? No. And I think that's the difference. You know, people do get over loss. I mean, I've lost people in my life. It's, you know, just like anybody else has. But the impact that they have on people's lives, they had when they were alive. You know, I don't have time to play the rest of the comment in its entirety because I'm running short on time now, but Scott talks a little bit in it about the placebo effect. The idea that being given something that really has no real medicine or so forth can still cause an improvement in somebody's condition. I don't know if that's really applicable when we're talking about a sense of loss, because you're talking about people's feelings and not really talking about a physical condition. We could talk about the placebo effect medically another time. I've been reading about it a few times lately, and it seems that the larger the study and the more comprehensive the study, the less effect placebos actually seem to have. And the placebo effect actually seems to affect very few people, to the point of it where it becomes really statistically negligible, and that it's a lot closer to the amount of improvement you're going to see in people who know that they're receiving no treatment but still improve anyway. So that's something that maybe, you know, we could talk about in another show. But can you make people feel better by lying to them? Yeah, I suppose that's true. I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to do. He talks about the placebo effect a little more and talks about how we as rationalists, people who have a scientific view of the world, people who are irrational thinkers, as opposed to having this magical thinking thing, the faith thing, are at a disadvantage for something like a placebo effect. And Scott, I think you're forgetting something very important. In a placebo treatment, you don't know that you're receiving a placebo. So unless you're going to doubt any treatment you get, then how is that going to affect this at all? I mean, because obviously, I mean, if you're thinking that you know, you can give somebody a placebo, and as long as they have a sufficient mind-body connection, the placebo will work on them as though it were actual medicine, I think you're on very, very shaky scientific ground there. And I think that if you were to read a little bit more into this topic, you would find that it doesn't quite work that way, and that the placebo effect isn't quite as strong as you seem to think it is. Though undoubtedly, there are people who attribute their recovery to the placebo effect, it's very, very rare indeed. Anyhow, I'm running out of time, so I just want to wrap up the show. Thanks for listening, and I will see you next time in episode number 53. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, signing off.